Welcome back to Season 9 of Talking with Traders. We're into the fifth year of this podcast that began in 2020. Once again, IG have come on board as the sponsor of the podcast. We're truly grateful to have such a global leader in online trading as our sponsors. In the coming weeks, I'll be interviewing various guests from around the globe on the topic of trading. Some of these will be past guests that we invite back onto the show, and some will be new guests. The idea is to attract a broad spectrum of different perspectives from various players in different areas of the markets. None of what you hear here is financial advice, but it is intended to get you thinking about how you might be able to apply what you hear here to your own trading and investing. Remember to subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast app. That way, you'll be notified when new episodes are released. Or if you watch these interviews on YouTube, please subscribe to our YouTube channel and give us a thumbs up and leave a comment if you wish. We welcome the engagement. Once again, thank you to IG for sponsoring this podcast into its fifth year, and thank you, listeners, for your continued support. Now, let's get on to this week's interview. Welcome back to episode 2 of season 9 of Talking with Traders. This time, our guest comes from the USA, comes from Colorado in the USA. His name is Sean McLaughlin, and he's the chief options strategist at All Star Charts and All Star Options. Some of the guests will remember we interviewed JC Peretz a while back on this podcast, and he was great value to have. But Sean is somebody that I watch very closely, and I watch a lot of your videos, Sean, and the work that you do, and it's great. And I wanted to get you on the podcast, so here you are, and it's a great privilege to be speaking to you. Welcome. Welcome to the podcast.
Well, I'm honored to have made the cut. Thanks for having me on. I'll try to make up for all the shortcoming of JC. I know he probably talked very little. He doesn't have much to say. So I'll try to, bring up the energy a little bit.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, JC, you know, really could do with a little bit more energy, couldn't he? Of course, we're being sarcastic, of course. Very, very energetic guy is JC, and very full of larger than life. Let's put it that way.
For sure, for sure.
So Sean, great to speak to you. As I said, it's an honor and a privilege. But as I always do with new guests on this podcast, I like to just get a little bit of background before we get into the more meaty stuff. Tell us about your career. How long have you been trading? What got you into the markets originally? All of that kind of, if you could give us like, I don't know, a 1 or 2 minute summary of your career to this point.
Sure. I started trading in 1998, kind of by accident, but not really, because I had always been interested in markets from an early age. One of my first jobs when I was an early teenager, probably 11, 12 years old, I got a newspaper delivery route. So I would deliver newspapers door to door in my neighborhood. And I have good memories of the 1987 stock market crash. I was 12 years old then. I had no idea what the heck it was about, but I was delivering newspapers, and the newspapers had huge headlines about this stock market crash. And I didn't know what that meant, but I found it fascinating. And that kind of put me down a rabbit hole of learning about stocks and what they are. And look, I came from a lower middle class family, which that might be putting it even generously. We might not even have been a lower middle class, might have been below that. So we didn't have much money in my house. And so to me, seeing money being talked about in the newspaper and stocks and the money that was being made and lost, that just kind of caught my attention. I'm like, oh, here's a way to make money. And you know, in my naivety of a 11, 12, 13 year old at the time, I thought that the way to make money in the stock market was to be a stockbroker. And that may have been true in the time. This was the 80s. So I kind of got in my head, I think, as a teenager in high school, that a career path for me might be becoming a stockbroker. Again, I didn't know anything else. I didn't really know about trading and what trading was. So to me, stockbroker was how you got involved in Wall Street. So that was always in the back of my head. But fast forward to I graduated college, I got a marketing degree in business school, which I always say that was the easiest way through business school. And that's why I got a marketing degree. I was working a job some of the guys I was working with, I became good friends with. And one of the guys was very interested in trading. And he kind of clued us into a fact that couple office buildings down from where we were working, there was a day trading firm. This was, again, late 90s. That was kind of a new thing that was popping up in the United States, where just anybody off the street who had, $50,000 to burn could go and open an account and learn how to trade. And my buddy had that kind of money, and he wanted to do it, and he kind of brought me along. And it's a bit of a long story, but the short story is I got interested, he got me interested, and I got involved, and so that's how I got involved in trading. And it's been what, almost 26 years now. And yeah, it's been a wild ride, that's for sure.
I'm sure it is. You've seen plenty in that time of 1998. So you were there for the dot-com burst, bubble and boom and bust. You're there
Yes.
for the financial crisis. You're obviously there for COVID
You
and
know, the
all of that.
dot-com bubble, I talk about this all the time. It was a great time to be trading for sure. In fact, the fall off of the bubble, when the bubble burst, that bear market, that crash, whatever you want to call it, I mean, that was some of the best trading that all of us that worked together had ever done. I mean, in a pure dollars amount, that's probably the most money I ever made in a very short period of time. And I like to tell people that as great as that was, I actually learned a lot of bad habits during
Okay.
that trading period because I was still very new. I didn't know anything. And I was learning techniques that worked in that very specific market, which was a very unique time in the stock market. So 99 to 2000, I mean, the Nasdaq, I think, doubled something. I mean, something crazy, something you very rarely see. And the moves intraday for intraday traders, I mean, there were stocks that were having 30, 40, $50 moves intraday every day.
Wow.
And so, we learned a lot of bad habits of like, oh, if I bought something and it went down, like, oh, just buy more because it's going to go up. And sure enough, it always did. And then on the flip side, when we were on the other side and the market was popping, all you had to do is get short any tech stock and just hold on, and you were buying it back, 50 points lower, that day or the next day. It was just unbelievable. And all these habits, all these tricks and habits that we learned during that time, they worked great then, but I've literally spent the last 20 years of my career unlearning all of those bad habits that I learned in those first 4 years of trading.
It's interesting, though, how they say that often the kind of environment you were brought up in, or the environment that the market was in when you were first introduced to the market, often tends to shape you. And I guess that's it. If you were introduced into that extremely volatile type of an environment, it takes a while to unlearn those kind of habits. And
Yep.
when you did that, were you trading the stocks themselves, or were you trading options at that stage?
So at that time, I was trading primarily, actually exclusively, NASDAQ stocks.
Okay.
Because at the time, this is kind of a market structure conversation, but at the time in the late 90s, the way the NASDAQ stock market worked, for anyone who's familiar with a level two window, the level two window still exists. It shows all the bids and all the offers. But today, all those bids and offers are just anonymous exchanges with sizes that don't really reflect the true size of the market participants. In the 90s, when I started, the level two window showed who the buyers and sellers were. It showed that it was Goldman Sachs, Merrill Lynch, Bank of America, Knight Trading, all these different firms. You knew who was there, and the size that they were showing was true size. So if Goldman Sachs was on the bid trying to buy 100,000 shares, you could see that. And that was very valuable information that we used to get in and out of trades. And when that went away in 2002, 2003, it really changed the structure of the market. And all the guys who did what I did then, I mean, they all left the business. In fact, I worked in an office of about 40 traders, most of them men. There were a couple women in there. But as far as I know, I've lost touch with many of them, but as far as I know, here we are 24 years later, I think I'm the only one left who's trading. There might be one other guy who's still trading. That doesn't mean I'm a great trader. It just means that, I don't know, maybe I adapted better than others.
That's so interesting because, as you say, yeah, you adapted and you stuck it out. Because I think there are loads of stories about people like that who were, even before electronic trading, guys that were on the floor and then were unable to adapt to the, time of electronic trading, and lost their jobs, or ultimately just couldn't make it in the markets and moved on to do other careers. So if you're one of those survivors, then that's really interesting. What do you think it is that kind of has allowed you to continue to be successful? Obviously, you talk about adaptability and so on, but taking away introducing that anonymity into the market, it is a big thing. I can well imagine. You guys at All Star Charts are, as the name says, charts. You're very much technical analysis driven. Do you think it's have something to do with that? You know, that it's the ability to read a chart, the ability to read price action, even without knowing who's behind the bid and the offer, that maybe has helped you to keep it going for this long?
Yeah, I recognized early on that I wasn't smart enough to understand the fundamentals of companies and understand that the narratives and the macro pictures that affect all these different stocks. I mean, sure, if I wanted to put a whole lot of effort into it, maybe I could get pretty proficient at fundamental analysis, but it to me it just didn't hold a lot of interest to me, and I felt like the price action, the stocks would move before the fundamentals were reflected, before we knew what the fundamentals were, right? We'd have to wait for an earnings report to get the latest updates or whatnot. So I learned that with technicals, and we say this, we borrow this phrase from our friend Brian Shannon all the time, that only price pays. And the price of the instrument that you're trading, whether it's a stock or a commodity or an option or a future, whatever that price is now, that's the price. That's the true value that the marketplace is placing on that instrument. It doesn't matter why. It doesn't matter why this thing's trading at $100 a share or whatever. The fact of the matter is, that's where the market is valuing it right now. And that's the only price that matters. You may disagree with that price, but if you disagree with the market for too long, you're in for a rough ride.
You'll get humbled very quickly. Absolutely. The market's always right. Price is king. And you're right. You don't want to fight against the price. Just read the price action. Interesting that you say that. So now, I mean, you're chief options strategist at All Star Options and All Star Charts. Is it right that I'm saying it both?
Well, All Star Charts is the company. All Star Options is just one of the services we provide under that umbrella.
So we are obviously. The question I want to ask you is do you eat what you kill? Because that's often what I think a lot of people listening to a podcast think. Is you talk about a trader. A trader is someone that, trades the market, buys, sells, and ultimately makes a living from trading. In the case of many people I speak to, and I include myself in this, we don't just trade for a living. You actually want to have some sort of other risk-free income sources outside of trading. So that's the question I've got for you before we get into some of the more sort of meaty stuff around options. But do you eat what you kill, or is this, are you generating your month-to-month living costs from other things?
No, I'm glad you're asking this question because this is an important question. And where I live in Colorado, I run a traders meetup group, and I get a lot of people who are very new to trading, maybe haven't even traded at all. They're just curious about it. And they get this question all the time, like, how soon can I quit my job and become a full-time trader? And I tell everybody that if you want to become a trader, you need to have another source of income for as long as possible. Ideally, you have a situation where you could trade while you're working or maybe outside of your working hours. I will tell you, Garth, myself personally, I've tried four or five different times in my career to solely make a living from trading. And for me, I am an absolute head case when that happens. I'm not ashamed to admit it. I've never had a big blow up or anything like that, but every time I have a good run, or many times in the past where I've had a really good run, I'm like, okay, here it is. This is it. Now I'm free. I'm just going to be a trader. That's all I'm going to do. And every single time, almost immediately, whatever I was doing stopped working. And I didn't have a blow up or anything like that, but I just couldn't make money, at least at the level that I was making before. And it led to nothing but frustration and heartbreak and worry and concern and all those things, all those emotions that we deal with. And so I've learned, the hard way through the proof that's in the pudding, that I need to have another source of dependable income that I at least know that my bills are getting paid, right? My rent is getting paid, my food is getting paid for, health insurance is good, like all the important things. And now my trading income is just kind of like, it serves two purposes for me. One, it's building wealth, trying to save for retirement, that kind of thing. And then also fun money, right? Like you, before we went live, you and I talked about how my family just went to Yosemite National Park last week. Like
Yes.
to be able to do fun things like that, that's what the trading income is for. But it's not for me to, meet my responsibilities from week to week. Because for me, again, I'm a head case, like, and it's something I need to work with. I've gone to therapy for this and tried to figure out the answers, and I can't figure out what it is, but it's like something shifts in my brain that whatever was working, now there's like too much, there's too much at stake, there's too much pressure, and the thought of losing money scares the hell out of me, and it puts me in a bad state of mind. So luckily for me, Garth, for the last 15 years or so, I've had three jobs that are stock market related, and it's been encouraged, almost a necessity for me to trade to do the job that I do well. So I've had the best of both worlds. I've got an income coming in, and I'm working on a job that is stock market related and related to what I do. So I'm very lucky in that regard for sure, and I'm grateful for that every day.
Yeah, so that's brilliant. So you're following your passion, and the work is what you love to do. That's awesome. So let's quickly talk about options, because that was why I got you onto the podcast. Because our sponsor for this podcast is IG Markets, as you know, and they've recently introduced tastytrade, which is an American company founded by Tom Sosnoff, who was also a guest on this podcast a little while back. And anyway, they've introduced tastytrade into the UK now, quite recently, and so it's kind of following on from this explosion of interest in the options market, which it was always there, but it seemed to really ramp up during COVID time. And we've seen huge increase in volumes during that time. So I figured, as our sponsor have got this product now, which allows people to trade options, and let's get an options guy on. So something I wanted to ask you is, what are some of your favorite option strategies to trade? Are there any favorite ones or ones that have historically made you the most money? Because there's so many different ways to trade options, aren't there?
Oh, there absolutely is. And shout out IG and shout out tastytrade. I am a big fan of tastytrade. I use their platform. I've been a user since the beginning. I know Tom, I know Tony, I know a lot of people over there at tastytrade. I'm a big fan. I love what they do and I love the service they provide. When people ask me, like, where can I learn about options? I send them to tastytrade. They have so much great free educational content. Great people. I'm not a paid spokesman. I'm just saying that because, as a fan, I love what they do and I use their platform. So anyway, to answer your question, what's my favorite option strategy? Well, this may surprise you, Garth, as somebody who uses every option strategy under the sun, more or less. I'm agnostic as to what strategy I will use. I let market conditions dictate what strategy I want to employ whenever I put a trade on. But my favorite trade in the world is not some multi-legged, four-legged option strategy that has various expirations and things like that. No, my favorite trade in the world is to buy a call or calls in a stock making all-time highs. That is my favorite trade in the world. And here's why. When a stock is making an all-time high, you got two things going for it. Number one, there's no overhead supply. Everyone who's an owner of that stock is making money. And there's no reason to sell, right? So people are just going to sit on their hands and let that thing go. And more buyers are going to come in and send that stock higher. And any unfortunate souls who happen to be short that stock, they're all losing money. And the only way they can stop the bleeding is to buy stock. So a stock making an all-time high is my favorite setup in the whole world. And I love to buy calls in those because typically speaking, when a stock is making an all-time high, there's very little fear in that market, right? No one's afraid that they're going to lose, half of their investment overnight. Sure, it could happen and it has happened, but it's so rare. People are not fearful, and people use the options market to hedge their positions when they're afraid they're going to pay higher prices for protection. They may, pay higher prices for puts, or they may, do all kinds of spreads that just drive demand for options, and that makes the prices of options go higher. But when a stock is in an all-time high, no one is afraid, no one is fearful, no one is worried about anything. So premiums and options tend to be very affordable, tend to be at the lowest prices in volatility terms that you'll find at any other point in the cycle. So I could buy call options at very attractive prices when a stock is making an all-time high. And Garth, you know this. If a stock's at 100 bucks and it's going to go to 200, it's going to go up every day for a while. And if I buy, calls at cheap prices, I could be in for a very long ride and get a very great return, a leveraged return on a simple call option. So yeah, I'm not afraid of doing multi-legged, option spreads that, may have different expirations, maybe a diagonal spread. I could talk all that stuff, and that's great, and that's complicated, and that scares people. But man, for me, just buying a simple call and sitting on my hands and letting the market do its thing, that's my favorite trade in the world.
And I mean, time away from expiry, because obviously there's a time decay factor to these things. And if you buy
Sure.
something that's too close to expiry, you get into that really steep theta part of the option where it starts to lose a lot of value quite quickly. I think that's usually in like the last 40 days or thereabouts. So do you typically buy sort of far dated and out the money, in the money options?
So typically speaking, if I'm putting on a trade that is long premium, right? So like if I'm buying a call or I'm buying a bull call spread or something like that, something where I'm purchasing premium, it's a debit when I buy it, right? I generally look to do no sooner than 3 months expiration. My window, my typical trades that I put on usually will be from 3 months to 12 months out. There's always exceptions depending on the situation. I have done longer trades. I have purchased leaps at times, but my sweet spot tends to be buying with at least 3 months expiration, anywhere from 3 to 12. Now, if I'm short premium, which haven't talked about yet, but then I tend to stick, no further than 2 months out because I want to catch that sweet spot of the option value decay.
Let's talk about that quickly because, obviously buying call options or buying put options is a simple kind of vanilla strategy when it comes to trading options. But of course, you can also short options, and that's where you're obviously selling the option to somebody else, so you're earning the premium. But of course, that introduces open-ended risk as well if you're just shorting naked options. Is that something you do? Do you ever go net written on a position or not?
Yes, I do. It's not something I do a lot of, and I do it tactfully, or is that the right word? I do it in the right situations. So I'll give you a few examples. I do run an ETF strategy where I just do this in ETF sector ETF. So like the retail and the communications and oil and bonds and whatnot, but the sector ETFs for those. I will sell what's called a strangle. So a strangle is where you sell an out of the money put and an out of the money call. I am comfortable doing naked options in ETFs because ETFs, they're a basket of stocks, right? They represent a basket of stocks. You don't have as much of a risk of a severe overnight gap as you would in an individual stock. So, I mean, we've all seen and we've all heard stories of an individual stock maybe coming out of an earnings report, or maybe there's a sudden change of the CEO or CFO that people didn't see coming, and bad news where the stock gets cut in half overnight, and there was no warning, and there's no way out. And if you're short naked puts in a situation like that, that's going to be a very painful existence for you. So I don't typically do naked options in stocks, but I do it in specific situations. I will sell naked puts in stocks, but there's a few caveats. There's a few conditions that must be met. Number one, it has to be a large cap stock that has a big following. Think stocks like Apple or Meta or Tesla or Amazon. Big companies that, Amazon's not going to get cut in half overnight. Neither is Apple. I mean, I guess supposedly it could, but it's unlikely,
It's unlikely,
right? So that's number one. It has to be a big cap stock with a huge volume. Number two, I have to have a very defined, clearly defined level of support. And this comes back to technical analysis. I need to see a very clearly defined level of support that I can lean against as my if nothing else, my mental stop, right? So
Right.
I'm going to see a
Okay.
stock that maybe had a big sell-off, a steep sell-off. We've bounced pretty significantly, and now it's holding that bounce. And now I could use that low of that sell-off as
Right.
my risk management level. Like, hey,
Yeah.
if this thing breaks here, I'm out. No questions asked.
Right.
So those are the conditions I have to have. I will not sell naked calls in stocks. There's with naked puts, I mean, it's trite to say it, but there is a stop, right? The stock
Yeah.
can't go below zero,
Yeah.
right? And also typically if I'm selling, I should have said this earlier, when I'm selling naked puts in stocks, they tend to be stocks that if I had to become an owner of the stock, because stock was put to me,
Yeah.
not the worst thing in the world. I like the company, I believe in the story, and I could be comfortable holding it for a little bit.
Right.
But with naked calls, there's theoretically unlimited upside a stock can move. And we've seen it many times where stocks that maybe you're selling off a little bit and you're thinking, oh, this seems like a great opportunity to sell some calls here because the stock's going down.
Yeah,
Well,
yeah.
you know what? When that stock's going down, all of a sudden in certain situations, that stock becomes a takeover candidate. And you might wake up one morning and find out that XYZ company just made a bid for your stock at double what you sold it for, or what, double whatever your short strike is. You're getting killed in that situation, and there's
Yeah.
no risk management you can do to help, repair
Yeah.
that damage. So I don't do naked calls for that reason. In stocks, I will
Yeah.
do them in ETFs,
Right.
and I tend to do it only when volatility is elevated. That puts the
Yeah.
edges in my favor a
Well,
little bit.
that's the other thing I was going to say is the volatility skew typically favors you on the left-hand side. In other words, selling puts, especially after there's been a heavy sell-off, volatility is high at that point. So you get paid fairly well for selling puts. You never get paid very well for selling calls because it's always on the right-hand side and the volatility is always lower out to the right-hand side.
Not only that, but you have a whole cottage industry of long-term investors who love to sell calls against their long-term stock as an income generation strategy, which is a great income generation strategy, but that is just a constant supply that's coming on the market that keeps call prices a little bit cheaper, out of the money call options cheaper than put options a similar distance away.
Absolutely. It's a covered call strategy, essentially,
Yeah.
what you're saying.
Right.
And let's talk about your approach to risk. I know in some of the marketing that you guys do, you talk about being able to, generate 200%, 300% return on investment in options. Now, I mean, you and I know that that's you're talking about the premium, right? So if you were to buy in your examples, let's say you bought a out the money call on a stock and you paid 5% of the value of the stock as premium, and that stock went up 20%. Well, now you've made 300% on the five premium, that you've paid away. So we understand that, but I think for a lot of people that maybe don't understand the idea around this kind of leverage and being able to make 200 or 300% return on investment, it's not total, like it's usually not your total capital, right?
Sure,
I
right.
mean, so the question I'm asking you is, when you enter one of these trades, let's just say you buy a naked a long call, what are you looking to pay away as premium? What are you willing to lose as premium on that if it doesn't work?
No, great question. Look, it's very sexy to say, "Hey, I made 500% on my call." Well, great. I'm assuming you didn't invest your whole account in that. If you
Correct.
did, wow, congratulations, you're doing great. But that was a
Yeah.
very risky move to do. You don't, the thing with options, and let's just keep it simple, let's talk about buying a call. Buying call options, there is a very real risk of a 100% loss on what you pay for the price of that option. It is not an immaterial risk, it is a very real risk. In fact, I lose 100% on options very often, more often than I would like. But that's okay if you do position sizing properly. And the way I do position sizing, I'm maybe a little bit more conservative than most, but I will rarely risk more than 1% of my account equity on any one options trade.
Right.
Sometimes I'll risk as much as 2, depending on the situation, depending on, if I'm feeling really confident in the trade, but certainly no more than 2%.
Yeah.
Anything more than 2%, you're asking for trouble. So If I buy an option and I risk 100, or if I risk 1% of my capital, of my entire trading capital, and that option goes up and makes me 5x on my money, that's a great return on the option, but I only really added 5% to my account. Not that 5% is anything to sniff at, especially if you made that over the course of 2 or 3 months. That's a great return for very limited risk. With options trading, position sizing is so important. In fact, more important than with, let's say, stock trading, for example. Because with stock trading, yes, you can leverage in, depending on your broker, they might give you 4x buying power intraday or 2x buying power overnight. You could get into a position that's bigger than what your capital can hold, but there's a limit to how much leverage they will give you. And, a 10% move against you might hurt, but it's not going to take you out of the game. But if you can easily over leverage in options without even thinking about it. And there's a very real risk of losing 100% of your investment in an option. So if you're going in and investing 50% of your capital in a long call trade because you're very bullish on the setup, if that doesn't work and it could work against you quickly, you're just lost half of your account. And I don't know about you, Garth, but it's the big losses that we have to fight against because the math doesn't work for trading if we're taking big losses, right? It's just too hard. If you lose 50% of your capital, you got to double your money to get back to even. And that's so hard to do. It's harder than you think.
Way harder. No, absolutely. I mean, look, there's what are those? There's five outcomes to a trade. What is a big win, a small win, a scratch, a small loss, and a big loss? Well, just make sure you don't get that last one. Don't take a big loss. The rest are normal in trading. But
You must be watching some of my videos because I talk about that all the time,
well,
right?
I watch your videos, but I watch a lot of videos. But that's it, right? It's the simple things. It's matter. Just keep the losses small. It's so important in this business. Live to fight another day.
And let me just add to that. You're absolutely right. And I say that all the time. The corollary to that, though, is that you do have to have those small or those occasional, infrequent, large winners to make all that math work, right? If we get rid of the large losers, that's great. That's step one. That's step A number one. You have to get rid of the large losers. The small winners and small losers will offset, wash out to be a net, nothing. You need those handful of large winners to make the math work. But sitting on winners might be the hardest thing that a trader does. In fact, I've had the good fortune of getting to know a really successful trader who's been featured in the Market Wizards books, Jack, or I'm sorry, Jack Schwager is the author, but Peter Brandt was in the most recent. He was in the most recent Market Wizards book. I think it's called Unknown Market Wizards.
Yes, that's right. Legend. I'm hoping to get him on this podcast at some stage.
He used to live near me here in Colorado. He's since moved, but he used to live near me, and I've had a good fortune to get to hang out with him, have some meals with him over the years. And when I first met Peter, one of the first things he said to me was, "The small losers never bother me, or any losers never bother me. I have a process to get out of those. I'm out, no questions asked. I don't argue with the market, and I take small losers all the time. In fact, I lose way more than I win, and that's pretty common for traders, right? But the thing that he said to me that stuck with me, he said, the hardest thing for me to do is to hold my winners because my biggest winners, and I'm speaking for Peter, he said, my biggest winners are always the trades that rip in my direction right away, right away. Like they just start moving right away. And when that happens, every bone in my body wants to take that profit because I've seen it so many times where it rips up in my favor, but then soon after completely rolls back. I've had that happen so many times, Peter said, that I want to take profits when that thing rips. But the thing is, when I look back at all my biggest winning trades, they all started off this way, or most of them started off this way. They ripped in my favor right away. Those were just the ones that didn't roll over soon after I got in. And so, holding those winners, that's the hardest thing we do. And you fight so many internal battles, with your psyche. You want to take that profit to feel like a big shot, or you want to take that profit because you're afraid it's going to roll over. But man, sitting on our hands watching those winners sounds like it's a good problem to have, but it's a problem. It really is for traders to sit on their hands when they're riding a big winner.
Absolutely. No, without a doubt. I mean, that for me is also the hardest part of trading is knowing the right time to sell. And what you're talking about there takes me back to another podcast I did with a guest many seasons back, but he had a great saying and he said, "It takes guts to be a greedy pig." And it's exactly that, right? It actually takes guts to hold that winner and to see it, continue to grow and continue to grow and fight off the urge to not take that profit and snatch at it, which we're all
Right.
so hardwired to do.
Right. And depending on your time frame, I'm more of a swing trader, right? So a trader like me, as a swing trader, those big wins, I mean, I might only get five big wins per year. And that's great and that makes my year, but that takes a certain kind of patience and a certain kind of mental fortitude to come to my trading desk every day and log in and look at my account and not do anything through the entire year while I'm holding some of these big winners, because there's only going to be three or four or five of them. And for some people, for some types of traders, that's impossible. There's no way they could only have five big winners over the course of a year to make their year. I mean, a day trader is probably laughing at me right now saying, "How do you do that? Like, I'm in and out every day. I'm doing so many trades." But that's my time frame, and that.
But I agree, and I find the same as well, because I think similar, I'm also a swing trader, and honestly, every year's performance largely just comes from a handful of trades, really. When you actually split them all out and actually analyze everything, you're right. There's lots of small wins and small losses, and it takes a couple of really big winners to just actually make your year.
Right,
And
absolutely.
they don't come all the time. They're sort of actually quite rare as it is. So Sean, I mean, we're getting towards the end of our allotted time that I asked you for. So I'm not going to keep you too much longer, although I'm enjoying this very much and I feel like we could talk for hours. But just a couple of things. First up, if you could go back to 1998, right? And you're young Sean McLaughlin and you've got your whole career ahead of you, and you could have a conversation with him now. What are one or two really, key lessons you've learned along the way that you would tell him and give him advice about what to be careful of and what to do in his
Well,
career?
this might be more specific to me, but I'm sure there's lessons for everybody here. I mentioned at the top where I started trading in 1998, and it was the dot-com bubble, and there was a lot of money being made by people in my room and by me as well. And if I were to go back in time and talk to a 23-year-old Sean, I would say, "You idiot, make sure you're saving money. You're not going to make this kind of money for the rest of your career. You may have spots where you make it, but when the getting is good, you need to put aside some money. You need to save money." I was terrible about saving money in my 20s, even in through my 30s mostly. I did not save for retirement the way I should have, and I did not save when I was making hay, right? Like during the good times, I was always like, "Oh, we're gonna let it ride. We're gonna let it roll. Let's go." So my advice would be much better about saving money, and be good about budgeting your money. Budgeting is something that is new to me. Maybe in like the five last, I don't know, 6 or 7 years. Maybe it's because I became a father and all of a sudden things mean more. I have a 10-year-old son now, but I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, I learned how to budget, like really budget my money, right? And where everything's going, and how to stay within a budget. And for me, that was a really transformational financial move for me and for my family. And so, yeah, if I'm talking to the 23-year-old Sean now, I would say, "Sean, be better at saving money and save money through thick and thin, no matter what. And get smart about budgeting. Stick to a budget, stick to a plan, and the nearly 50-year-old self, which is what I am now, will greatly thank you for it." That's my advice.
Great advice. Fantastic. Well, Sean, with that, I'm going to wrap it up because we've come to the end of our time and it has been superb speaking to you. I mean, I didn't get through all of the questions that I was wanting to ask you, but I just think we had such a good conversation, shooting the breeze and going a little bit off-piste here and there. It worked well and I've thoroughly enjoyed this. Thank you so much. Last thing, I guess, is for listeners that want to follow your work, that want to get in touch with All-Star Charts, see what you're doing with the options. You guys put out a huge amount of great content, so compliments to all of you there. But how can listeners get in touch, or where can they go to follow your work?
Oh, thanks, man. To get in touch with me directly, probably the easiest way is to follow me on Twitter. My handle is Options Sean on Twitter. So that's where you can reach me directly. If you're interested about my work at All Star Charts or just all the technical analysis research we do at All Star Charts, just go to allstarcharts.com. You can find it there. And we also do a lot of live content every day at stockmarkettv.com. So we have a morning show before the market's open every day. I do some shows throughout the week and lots of great content for people who are into technical analysis. We even touch on macro from time to time, and we always have wonderful guests on, and I do a podcast where we interview traders as well. That also could be found at stockmarkettv.com. So check those out. We'd love to have you involved in our community, and I think you'll find that me and everyone at All Star Charts, we love what we do. We love interacting with the community of traders. And Garth, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. It's a long time coming. Thanks, finally. Season 9. I love it. Good job, buddy.
Like your episode number 106. So yeah,
Wow.
we're
Impressive. That's
certainly
well done. Well
getting
done.
getting some good guests under the belt, and it's great to add you to that list.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Sean. That's really been awesome, and yeah, we'll keep in touch. Hope to speak again sometime.
All right. Thanks for having me.
All right, cheers. Thanks for joining us for this week's episode of Talking with Traders, sponsored by IG, a world-leading CFD provider. We really are privileged to have such a strong global provider of online trading services as our backer for this podcast series. Remember to subscribe for more episodes by clicking on the subscribe button of your favorite podcast app. Or if you're watching on YouTube, please subscribe to our YouTube channel, give us a thumbs up, and leave a comment. We welcome the engagement. Till next time.